Without further ado, tough questions, real answers.
Thank you, everybody. I'm real excited to be here, and all this stuff is very near and dear to my heart, and obviously on a cold, slippery winter night, if you're here, then you know these are important questions to you, too. I'm going to kind of lay a basic premise out on the table, I think, that'll point the direction of our discussion. And the premise that I am operating from is in contrast to a popular notion. There's a popular notion out there that says that faith and science are two different spheres of knowledge and have nothing to do with each other. It's sort of like separation of church and state. You got separation of faith and science. You know, well, you know, you get your religion and that's all fine, but don't mix it with science. Don't, you know, the two should belong in their own cage, you know. And religion should be in a smaller cage, you know, usually. And I vehemently disagree with that. I think that is a huge, huge mistake. I understand when secular people want to do that. Okay, that's sort of what you would expect. You'd expect your religious people to do that. What is the worst crime, though, is when Christians do that. That is even worse. Okay, I think it's very shameful when Christians look at science as though all scientists are enemies of the Bible, and that they're all, you know, all the stuff they publish is just a bunch of, well, there's some truth to that sometimes, but really, my view is that, well, in Romans 1 it says God has revealed himself through what has been made so that all are without excuse. Okay, that God's attributes, his divine power and his eternal nature is revealed through what has been made. Just this morning I got an email from John Fancher who was replying to somebody, and John said God wrote two books. God wrote the universe and God wrote the Bible. And we read both of them, and we read both of them together. And the way that and when you take two kinds of knowledge and you hold them in both hands and you try to bring them together, that's where you really learn how to think. Okay? That's where you really get to stretch the brain cells and say, okay, how do I bring these together? How do I harmonize this? And of course, we all have to do that. Even from the standpoint of being Christians, you know, a person who's 60 years old and has been around the block a few times and been through life is naturally able to understand the Bible much better than somebody who's 15 years old and hasn't seen any of life, right? Why? Because the Bible is about real life. And so my starting point here is that we're bringing these two spheres together. And as an observation, I think you'd have to be hiding under a rock to not have noticed the last year or so, especially how much sparks and battle has been going on in the press and in the popular media and in popular society about creation, evolution, intelligent design, whether this has a place in science. The conversation has become much more strident in the last year, and I would submit to you it's because there's never been a time in the history of man when the evidence of a supreme designer has never been more obvious than it is now. Science speaks louder for the Judeo-Christian worldview and for God as we understand God than it has ever spoken. Because science is the presumption that the world operates according to discoverable laws. And every discovery of those discoverable laws tells us something about the lawgiver who created the world in the first place. And so a Christian need not fear science. A Christian should embrace science and love science. And the great scientists of the past, like Isaac Newton and Boyle and Galileo and Copernicus and those guys, they looked at the science they did as being an act of worship. that this was a way of reading God's book. Now I got a question for you. And what I want is I want your knee-jerk reaction. I want you to tell me the first thought or feeling or impression that you have when I say a word. Okay? And I want a few people at least to tell me what you think. What do you think of and what do you feel when I say Big Bang? Anybody?
Beginning.
Random.
Big joke.
Big what?
Joke.
Anybody else?
Theory.
Evolution. Theory. Okay. That's good. To pick out a couple. Random. That was joke. Evolution. I want to start with Big Bang because this is one of the most fascinating aspects of science, and I think some of you will I think some light bulbs will go on with this. I have here the opening chapter, Genesis chapter 1, and it says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." That's verse 1. Now this is a Bible with commentary on the pages. Now tell me, how much commentary is there on verse 1 in this study Bible?
There's about three quite good sized paragraphs.
You actually get 1, 2, 3, and then 4, 5,
oh, those are one and
6.
Oh, I didn't see that. Okay.
No.
I need to leave.
No, I'm not trying to embarrass you.
That wasn't one of the tough questions.
Because it's got a little... No. You have this one sentence, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," and you've got... And of course, if you go by a real commentary, pages and pages and pages. How can you say pages and pages and pages about one little verse, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth"? Because there is a ton of information packed into that statement. Okay? It is a declaration that there is a beginning. Okay? And that before the beginning God was. Okay? And that God created out of nothing. That's what the word means. God created out of nothing. And the word, the Hebrew word for heavens and earth, means everything. In the beginning, in other words, at the beginning of time, time has a beginning, God, who lives outside of time, created out of nothing everything that is. Now that is a powerful statement. And it is unlike what any other world religion ever said. Okay, now, let's go back about 100 years before, if we go to before 1900, here was the scientific view of the universe. The scientific view of the universe was called steady state, that the universe had always been here, that matter and energy couldn't be created or destroyed, so it must have always been here. That the universe was infinitely old and large. The universe just went on in a static condition, that it wasn't changing. And because it was infinitely old, whatever theory of evolution had all the time that it needed to work. Okay? And that's before Einstein, that's the view. Well, the Big Bang Theory was proposed by a guy named George Lemaître in the late 1920s, and George Lemaître was a Catholic priest and physicist. And he was ridiculed for his Big Bang Theory. Lemaître said, I think the universe starts at a specific point in time and that it came out of a single point, and they said, "You silly Catholic priest, you, with your silly Bible point of view." Okay? And one of the early people who opposed the Big Bang was Fred Hoyle, a famous physicist. He coined the term Big Bang, and it was a derisive term. He made up this term because he didn't like it. The reason he didn't like it was he wasn't a Christian. He hated Christianity. It sounded too Christian. And so he made up this term as a way of mocking this theory that everything exploded out of a single point at a certain point in time, and the name stuck. Okay? So, quiz. The Big Bang was first described by Eddington, Einstein, Penzias and Wilson, Edwin Hubble, or somebody else. Does anybody have a vote? We'll get to that question in a little while. Let's talk about Einstein. In 1905 and 1917, he came out with his theory of relativity, and he discovered that time is relative and all kinds of stuff that I don't have time to go into tonight. But his equation said that the universe had to be expanding. Okay, well, if the universe was expanding, that means if you work it backwards, it must have come down to a point. All right? That implies that there's a beginning, and it implies it had to be begun by something. And so between him and Lemaître, the Belgian priest, and some other people, they came up with a new theory. It was the universe began a finite time ago. The universe had a transcendent beginning. In other words, it had to have been started by something outside of space and time, because Einstein's theory of relativity proved that space and time go together. And if you have no space, you have no time. Which, by the way, Aquinas said that 800 years earlier. And that the universe is undergoing a general continual expansion. And so if you work the clock backwards to the beginning, you have this dot that gets smaller and smaller and smaller until it becomes a point that is infinitely small, and then you go back any further than that and there's nothing. There's no time, there's no space, there's nothing. Okay, and Einstein's math showed that had to be the case. The universe at the beginning was infinitely small. Time itself began at the beginning, and the universe was made out of that which we cannot measure or detect. Because what Einstein said was that we live inside space and time, and we cannot look outside of space and time. So whatever started the universe is beyond us, and that we cannot know anything about it. And this unified the four laws of physics. It proves that cause and effect exist outside of time, because something had to cause time to happen. Okay, and so this was the new theory. And of course, I told you Fred Hoyle ridiculed the theory. Arthur Eddington, who was a famous physicist, he says, it requires a sudden and peculiar beginning of things. He said, philosophically, the notion of a beginning is repugnant to me. Why was it repugnant to him? Because it demanded something outside of science to explain science. Einstein didn't like it either, and he put a fudge factor in his equation to make his universe a steady state universe instead of an expanding universe. And he eventually retracted that, and he said it was the worst mistake of his career. And the reason he did it was he didn't like the idea of God. Now, you can go study about Einstein. When he was a kid, he went to Sunday school, and he liked the stories about Jesus. When he got a little older, he started reading skeptical literature, and he got talked out of it, and he became a secular scientist. And his Big Bang theory started him on an inquiry going the other direction. One of the reasons I'm here is because of all the secular literature out there. And there is an assault on Christian thinking and on the Christian worldview that is just ongoing and relentless. And I think there's a couple reasons for it. One is science speaks loudly of a creator, and it takes a pretty loud bunch of noise to drown that out. Okay, and the second thing is there's a lot of lazy thinking in Christianity. There's a lot of people that they don't want to try to bring faith and science together. They don't want to have to think, or they just want to sit and watch TV and microwave popcorn and drink beer and be entertained and not think. Okay? But you know, when the Bible says work out your faith with fear and trembling, I mean, this is something that requires thought. It's something that requires an engaged mind. And so, let's talk about scientific evidence for the Big Bang. The theory of general relativity, which is Einstein's fundamental theory that he came up with in the early 20th century, it's been confirmed with scientific instrumentation and all that to one part in 100 trillion. Okay? And so, I mean, that's the mathematical basis for all of this, that Einstein's theory of relativity was right, and modern physics has definitely confirmed that. Astronomy Magazine, December 2002, said all roads of evidence lead to the Big Bang. No other theory comes even close to the evidential base supporting it. In other words, we'll talk about evolution later, and there's a lot. Evolution is a very murky subject, okay? There are so many things you can say about it. There's so many things to argue about. There's as many things to argue about as there are animals in the zoo, okay? But the Big Bang is not like that, okay? There are problems, there are aspects that are unsolved, but for the most part, it's one of the best attested to theories in science, because with the Hubble, remember about 10 years ago, the Hubble telescope got out there and they started taking all these pictures. I mean, we can see to the very edges of the universe, and we can see what evidence of the very earliest moments of the universe. And it all creates a very consistent set of data. You have the beginning, and time and space begins, and then if you guys want to, you know, get a copy of my PowerPoint presentation or something, I know you won't be able to see all this, but you know, we're 13.5 billion years out from the Big Bang. Time and space begins at zero. Light appears, matter appears, stars appear, light and galaxies appear. The universe is not capable of supporting life for a very long time. Solar system and planet Earth form about 4 billion years ago. Our sun forms. A Mars-sized collision with the Earth forms the Moon, and very shortly after, life appears on Earth. Jeffrey Burbidge, when all of this Hubble telescope stuff started coming in and a whole bunch of new data came in, it started to confirm the Big Bang theory much more rigorously than it had ever been before, and it put it on solid footing. And Jeffrey Burbidge is a famous atheist astronomer, and he said he was complaining on a radio show that his astronomer friends might rush off to join the First Church of Jesus Christ of the Big Bang. Okay? Now, why did he say that? Why would an atheist physicist say, my friends are all rushing off to join the First Church of Jesus Christ of the Big Bang? Because the Bible is the only book that describes time and space in a cosmology that matches modern physics. Hinduism doesn't, Buddhism doesn't, Mormonism doesn't, the Judeo-Christian worldview does, as I will explain. And so, I'm moving really fast here because we don't have a lot of time. By the way, you know, if you guys want to go deeper into this stuff, maybe we can have some other session. But the universe comes into existence, and then our solar system. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning, God created, bara is the Hebrew word, the heavens and the earth. The universe did not always exist. God existed before the universe. Bara means make something brand new or something out of nothing. Creation ex nihilo is the word that people have usually used, out of nothing. And that the heavens and the earth refers to the entire physical universe. All right? So the universe was made transcendently independent of matter, energy, space, and time. What does Hebrews 11:3 says? It says, by faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command so that what is seen was not made of what was visible. Okay? The visible was made from that which is invisible. Time had a beginning. Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose wrote a paper about 30 years ago that worked out the math of this with much greater precision. 2 Timothy 2:9 says, the grace was given us in Christ Jesus before the beginning of time. That God planned not only the universe, but our salvation and our relationship with Him before the beginning of time, outside of space and time. The hope of eternal life, Titus 1:2, which God, who does not lie, promised before the beginning of time. Now again, the fact that the Bible describes time as having a discrete beginning is totally unique in all of the religious literature in the world. Yes, Pat?
Question for you. I just want to make sure I'm clear in my own head. When you describe Big Bang, you're using Big Bang now.
Right.
Are you using Big Bang as that's the moment God decided to start the universe, or is this where the smallest part of... I'm a little...
Okay, let me describe what I mean by Big Bang.
Okay.
What I mean by the Big Bang is that at a moment, at time equals zero, time began, all the matter in the universe was compressed into an infinitely small speck. And starting at that moment, began to expand extremely fast. Okay, and modern physics, they can give you all the numbers. They can say it was this big at 10 nanoseconds, and it was this big at 3 seconds, and it was this big at 10 seconds, and it was this big at 2 minutes, and it was this, I mean, they've got this figured out. Okay, and here's when gravity was formed, and here's when light was formed, and here's when, you know, the attraction of protons and neutrons were formed, and I mean, and this is a very specific... See, this is not haphazard. There's nothing haphazard about it, as I will explain in a couple of minutes. And so the Big Bang describes an event. It describes the beginning of time. And it describes all of the matter in the universe coming out of a single point. Okay? If you get in a debate with an atheist about this, the hardest thing that they cannot possibly explain, because I've been through this, is, okay, what caused this to happen? Because this is a violation of everything that we know. The conservation of matter and energy says matter and energy can't be created nor destroyed. But it got created right then, and it did not exist before. There is no before. Okay? And you can read some pretty loopy logic trying to basically... do a snow job on not really ever answering the question. Okay? Which, you know, I don't have time to go into that. But again, the biblical worldview, biblical cosmology, and modern astronomy, they match tit for tat. So if we take Genesis 1 and we match it up to the Big Bang and modern astronomy, here's what we get. Okay? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Heavens, the universe, and the earth appear at 0 seconds. The earth was formless and void, and darkness covered the face of the earth, and the Spirit of God moved up on the surface of the deep. Now, this is not like the official Vineyard thing, and other people may disagree with this, but I'm gonna give you my way of interpreting Genesis chapter 1. Is I come to it with just three assumptions. Assumption number one is that when it says, you know, on the first day, the second day, the third day, the fourth day, that a day is not a 24-hour day, that a day is a period of time. 24-hour days do not begin to happen in that story until the fourth day anyway. Okay? Day is not a day. Secondly, that the story starting from verse 2 is told from an earthly point of view, not from an omniscient point of view. So it's describing what you would see from the earth's surface starting from verse 2. And number 3, the third assumption I'm going to make is when it says the Spirit of God moved upon the surface of the deep, the Hebrew word in the NIV, I think it says hovered. That Hebrew word is used only one other place in the Bible. It's used somewhere else in the Deuteronomy or somewhere. I'd have to go look it up. But in that verse, it describes an eagle protecting its children and guarding them. Okay? The third assumption I'm going to make in reading Genesis 1 is that that is when life, the seed of life, was planted on the earth, in verse 2. Okay? Now, if I make those three assumptions, which are their little nuances compared to the Sunday school version that you would teach your kids, that if I make those three assumptions, Genesis 1 and any modern physics book, any modern astronomy book, match up tit for tat, all the way down the line. It's all correct. Let's look. Day one. God says, let there be light, and light appeared, and God was pleased with it and divided the light from the darkness, daytime and darkness, and then that's the end of day one. Okay? Let the vapors separate to form the sky above and the oceans below, so there's clouds and there's sea. Let the water be gathered into oceans so that the dry land will emerge. Let there be grass, plants, and trees. And that's the end of day three. Okay? Day four, God made two lights, the sun and the moon. Well, in the timeline of modern physics, astronomers understand that that's when, that after plants began to multiply on the earth, the atmosphere went from opaque to transparent so that you could actually see the sun and the moon, which were necessary for animals who regulate their biology according to the cycles of day and night. And so the sun and moon were already there, but you can see them on day four. Okay? Day five, let the waters teem with fish and other life. Let the sky be filled with birds of every kind. Day six, let the earth bring forth every kind of animal, wild animals, cattle and reptiles, and man. And then that's the end of day six. And notice that day seven is never said to come to an end. And I would argue that we are in day seven now because God has rested from his creation. It never says, and there was evening and morning, a seventh day. We're in the seventh day. And so you can take all of this and you can lay it alongside Genesis, and the Genesis story and modern science match tit for tat. And I don't have time to go into all these little things. Now, the Big Bang sounds haphazard. I want to show you something. Got a little spray bottle here, comes from the kitchen cabinet. If I tighten this up and I squirt it, can't tighten it too tight, this just evaporates into a mist, right? All right? Like if you were trying to spray this on a mirror and wipe the mirror down, this is probably not the setting you want, right? Now, on the other hand, if you're trying to spray a mirror, how about this setting? That's not too useful either, is it, right? Okay? And what you need, if you want the water to evenly distribute in a spray, you have to get this just so. Now, that maybe that's about right. It missed my hand. That's just about right, right? And so we have this little tweak on a spray nozzle. Okay, well, you can say the same thing about the matter that went out from the Big Bang in terms of the force of the Big Bang. Because if we tighten this down, the nozzle's really small, everything just squirts out into a mist and it evaporates in the air. It doesn't even land on the floor, right? If we have this too loose, the thing just bloop, drips on the floor. And if you want it the right grade in between, then you have to adjust it in between. Well, there's a similar thing that we can describe in the Big Bang, because the Big Bang happened with a certain amount of force and a certain amount of speed, okay, and then everything starts going out. If it had been too fast, all the matter in the universe would have just sprayed out and never come together. There would never be any stars or planets or anything. It would just psss, okay? If the force of the Big Bang had been too weak, it would have gone out, and then gravity would have sucked it all back in, and the whole universe would be a big black hole. All right? Now, here's what's interesting. Do you know how fine the difference is if we're tweaking that nozzle? You know how fine the difference is between too much and too little? A 120 decimal places of precision. 0.00000000000000001. If it was that much too much, it would have been a spray and there would be no stars and no planets. If it had been that much too little, it would be a black hole. 120 decimal places. Roger Penrose, who did the paper with Stephen Hawking in the 1970s where he worked out Einstein's equations, which is one of the most important papers in modern physics, Penrose says it's 240 decimal places of precision. Now, the most precise piece of human-engineered equipment that exists is a gravity telescope on the West Coast, and it has a resolution to 23 decimal places of precision. That's the best man-made engineering can do at the present moment. But God engineering is 120 decimal places. So you think God's a little smarter than we are? Okay? And by the way, this thing that I'm discussing with you right now, this is not a controversial fact. This is not something that anybody can really challenge you on. They can plug all this math into computers and they can figure out, and it has to be so precise. Okay? And really, the only way around this is say, well, there must be an infinite number of universes, and one of them had to come out right, so it must be ours. Well, if you're trying to avoid talking about God, is it any different to talk about a whole bunch of other universes that we can't go check out? Is it any more scientific to say one thing than the other? Actually, no. And so, the Big Bang was the most precise event in all of history. It wasn't haphazard. It wasn't accidental. It was planned. It was engineered. And it was caused by an agent outside of space and time that sounds suspiciously like the Christian description of God. So what does 21st century astronomy tell us about God? It tells us that He exists. He transcends our universe and is outside of space and time, is vastly wise and intelligent, is action-oriented, very creative, created our universe, is a careful, loving creator. And He functions in our universe because of the things that we see subsequently happening. Couple quick questions before we get more bugs in our teeth and keep moving. Anybody? Yes, sir. What's your name?
Jacob.
Mathematically speaking, if something is infinitely small, it's always been my understanding, and I'm not a math expert by any means,
yep,
but it's always been my understanding, say you have something and then you cut it in half. You cut that half in half. You cut that half in
right.
half in half.
Right.
You're constantly going back, but you never get to that point.
Right. Well, in physics, that problem is restated a different way, which is, it's something called Planck time, And a Planck time is 10 to the minus 43 seconds. And it's the smallest unit of time that you can actually measure in physics before you get into uncertainty. And so they can talk about the Big Bang all the way down to the first 10 to the minus 43rd of a second. And before that, your question becomes something that's beyond the reach of modern physics to actually describe. Anybody else really quick before we...
Humphrey's recent research with Starlight and Time?
I'm somewhat familiar with that book.
Where he reworks the equations with Einstein and comes up with a different time thing that
right.
maybe the what we observe as time, all these millions and billions of years, really can just be an observation, but not the real measure of time, and that that could bring it more in line with the biblical account of a shorter creation period. And
that's a huge topic. And let me, if you want to talk about it afterwards, we can. He is far outside the mainstream of modern physics with that. And his theory also, I believe, requires that to understand that the speed of light is changing. I could be wrong on that, but I don't think so. As an electrical engineer, I would be highly skeptical of somebody saying that the speed of light is changing, because there's all kinds of stuff I could talk about that. But I would submit to you that there's a certain camp within Christianity that is very dogmatic that day in Genesis is 24 hours. And that dogma, that the dogmatic approach to that question is really mostly only been with us since the 1960s when Henry Morris wrote some of his books. That if you go back and you look through church history, this has been discussed by many, many people long before modern science as an undecided question. Origen wrote about it. Augustine wrote about it. Aquinas wrote about it. Nemiades, who's a Jewish scholar in the 12th century, wrote about it. I called up a friend of mine who's a Jewish rabbi in Florida, and I said, Harlan, what's the Jewish history of this discussion? And he sent me a whole chapter of a book that had all kinds of views on what day meant in Genesis and how long. And so I think that, for purely textual reasons, when you look at day three, when the earth was filled with plants and vegetation and everything, well, how fast do plants grow? You have to, somehow or another, let's put it this way. The only way you can square a young earth reading of the Bible with modern science is to assume that modern physics has a gross misunderstanding of the laws of physics prior to the completion of creation. And that may be philosophically consistent, but I think you run into theological problems with that. I would also add that the real anchor point of young earth creation is not any of those things. It's the interpretation of Romans 5 that says that death came into the world through Adam. And if you read Romans 5 very carefully, you will see it's talking about spiritual death, not physical death. And if you read Romans 5 and you insert physical death, it does not make sense. And so my contention is death existed on earth before the fall. But when Adam and Eve, when God said, in the day you eat of this, you will surely die, they knew what die meant because they knew what death was. Okay, and die did not mean they die physically, because they didn't die physically then. They would die spiritually, which, of course, we understand they did. And so Romans 5 describes spiritual redemption, not a physical redemption. So that's a big subject. We could talk about that afterwards. I'm gonna keep moving forward. I get pulled into this whole question of intelligent design and everything because of questions that I was being asked. My brother My younger brother is a very smart guy. He started asking a bunch of questions about this stuff, and I always felt like this, all this creation evolution stuff, I don't know enough to know. It's a huge subject. And, you know, I can't just go, well, Murphy's Law says that, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I'm going to race through a whole new aspect here. And this has been a huge discovery for me in the last couple years. Is life random? Is evolution random? Some new discussion for the origins debate. What I first wanted to talk about is naturally occurring patterns, and the whole question, could life have happened naturally? Could life have spontaneously happened on the earth, or did God have to create it? And so the first thing that I want you to consider, I've got here a little picture of a tornado cloud. Now, when there's a tornado going on in Kansas, did anybody design that tornado? No. Tornadoes, they happen. Hurricanes happen. Weather happens. Clouds happen. And it's a kind of order that happens naturally. In science, it's called chaos. But if you have the right conditions, hot air, cold air, moisture, and time, you get tornadoes and hurricanes. Another naturally occurring pattern is snowflake. If you have water and cold air, gravity and wind and time, you get snowflakes. They just happen. Nobody has to design a snowflake. It just happens. Now let's talk about something a different kind of a something. Let's look at music. Is music designed? Yes, somebody has designed music. Now, music occurs in two forms. All designs happen in two forms. Music exists as a plan before the song is played, which, you know, in this case would be a sheet of music, right? Or at least an idea in Fancher's head before he starts strumming his guitar, right? There's a plan that precedes the design, okay? And then the plan is carried out. And so you've got the sheet music and you get the musicians playing the music. Another example of a plan preceding a design would be software, okay? If you've got a Microsoft Windows CD at home, that CD has a bunch of ones and zeros on it, right? Well, the ones and zeros are the plan. But when you load it on your computer and you use it, that's the design. Okay? Anything that's designed, there's a plan that precedes the design. So there's a plan first, which is expressed in the form of a language. In computers, it's ones and zeros. In music, it's music notation. And then there's the implementation of the actual thing. Well, let's look at the difference between tornadoes and snowflakes and that kind of thing versus things like music and maps of Washington, D.C. Naturally occurring patterns, they come from chaos. They're just matter and energy flowing around. They require no thought or plan by anybody. On the other hand, designs are always based on a code. Music notation, is that a code? This is a G, this is an E, this is an F, this is an A, right? It's based on a code. Matter and energy and information. Information being a distinct entity. And it requires no thought requires thought from somebody to happen. Designs always require thought. Now, let's talk about DNA. DNA, without going into a big biological lecture here, DNA is a helix with little protein letters in the middle, A, C, G, and T. Okay? And every cell in your body has a strand of DNA that has 3 billion letters in it. And those letters describe the plan for you. Okay, the simplest microorganism that you can find has 500,000 letters of DNA. 500,000. Okay, not 20. 500,000. All right? DNA is a code. That's why we have the word genetic code. Is the arrangement of those letters describes the organism that's going to get built. A DNA molecule symbolically represents something other than itself. Your DNA is a plan for you, but your DNA is not you. Right? You are you. And you've got billions of cells with DNA, but all those cells has a plan for you. So which is DNA more like? Is DNA like snowflakes and hurricanes? Or is DNA like Microsoft Windows and music and English and Chinese? Well, DNA is in the latter category. It's not the former. So here's the question. Where do codes come from? Patterns like snowflakes and hurricanes happen naturally, but random processes don't create codes. Nobody has ever discovered a code that was not designed by somebody. Think about that. Nobody has ever discovered a code that was not designed by somebody. So this is my proof. And this is what I've been debating on the atheist forums and making people very angry. Number one, DNA, what?
That's not hard to do.
No, it's not. No, they're already angry. That's right.
Big trick.
Yeah. Perry the magician. See, here, this right here, this is a proof of intelligent design. And you can take this to the bank. DNA is a code. All codes that we know the origin of are designed by a mind. Therefore, DNA must have been designed by a mind. It's that simple. This is so simple, you can't argue with it. You can try, but I'm going on 6 months on a thread on the Infidels discussion board, and it's like, you know what it's like. I mean, I don't mean to sound like I'm bragging, because honestly, I haven't really enjoyed it at all. In all seriousness, I really don't enjoy it, but it's like a dojang full of guys doing martial arts. And it's like the Matrix, you know, here comes all these guys, and you got a little piece of logic that is so simple nobody can poke a hole in it, and it's just like, okay, and the longer it goes on, the madder they get, and they just keep bringing up the same objection over. DNA is not a code. Go look in a biology book. Okay? But wait a minute. I know a code that wasn't designed. Clouds are a code. No, clouds are not a code. Gravity is a code. No, gravity is a field. Gravity is not a code. There's no symbols. You know? And it goes on and on and on. Well, okay, but number three still does not necessarily follow. There must be something else. Yeah, there could be something else. But nobody's ever discovered it. So you can either be honest and admit that you're going to keep looking, or you can accept what is like should be obvious. Okay, enough of that. So I call this the atheist riddle. Show me a language that does not come from a mind. Show me a code that was not designed by a mind. It's so simple, any child can understand it. It's so complex, no atheist can solve it. Okay, part three. An atheist and a Christian go to the zoo. Now that should be entertaining. Okay, here, where have we been so far? We have established that the Big Bang is all the matter and energy and time in the universe coming at a single point in time out of nothing, creation out of nothing. That the Genesis account matches modern cosmology exactly, tit for tat. Okay? And that DNA, you can prove DNA was designed, because designs don't happen accidentally. Nobody's ever seen it happen. Okay, so what about evolution? All right, well, it's a murkier topic. Rather than arguing about apes and humans and stuff, is your daddy a Neanderthal, is your daddy a ape, and all that kind of stuff? Instead of arguing about that, let's frame it this way. Could an antelope have evolved into a giraffe? Did it need a longer neck, so it got a longer neck over millions of years because it needed one? Well, it's a good question. Now, here's the thing, is that everybody's always arguing about all these fossils and everything. And it's an argument that you can never get to the bottom of, because you're arguing about anecdotal evidence. It's kind of like somebody says, well, I took echinacea today and I didn't get sick. Therefore, echinacea keeps you from getting sick. Now that may be true. It may be false. It may be 10% true, it may be 80% true, it may be 50% true, but if you didn't get sick today and you took echinacea, does that prove anything? No. Okay, now if somebody shows you, here's a fossil of a horse and here's a fossil of a dog, see how similar they look, does that prove anything? No. Doesn't mean it didn't happen, and honestly, I'm open to a number of interpretations. I'm open to the possibility that an antelope did evolve into a giraffe. But what they're arguing about, they'll never get to the bottom of it. Okay? You have to have better information than, well, you got this fossil, and I got this fossil, and we all throw bricks at each other and throw chairs at each other until somebody wins or whatever. Have to do better than that. And so, you have to reduce the question to first principles. And so, now let's talk about... I'm getting ahead of myself here. Darwinian evolution says that random variations in a species, random mutations of the DNA that accidentally happen, cause new features to emerge, and then the animals with new features win, and the ones with lousy features go extinct. And then you end up with humans, right? That's Darwinian evolution. That's what it says. It's real simple. Random mutation plus natural selection equals design. That's Darwinian evolution. Well, I run a consulting business. I help all kinds of people advertise on Google. And Google is very, very, very Darwinian. Google weeds out the losers and makes the winners come to the top. On the left side here, you've got the free listings on Google. And on the right side, you've got the paid listings. Now, the way these paid listings, like if somebody's selling a red wagon, the way this works is somebody bids on the word red wagon. They say, I'm willing to pay 25 cents a click. When somebody sees my ad and clicks on it, and then they come to my website and hopefully they buy a red wagon. That's how it works. Well, Google's system works where the more people click on your ad moves up and you pay less. And if your ad is not popular, if you wrote a crummy ad that nobody wants to click on, your ad goes down, and if you want it to go up, you have to pay more and more. Now, is that Darwinian or what? It's brilliant, okay? And they sell $7 billion of clicks this way. So, what you do is you test different ads. So, like, here's a real example from a real customer, and they got two ads. Simple self-defense for ordinary people, easy personal protection training, tftgroup.com. The other one says simple self-defense for ordinary people, fast personal protection training, tftgroup.com. What's the difference between these two ads?
Easy
and fast. It's the only difference. Do you think that makes a difference in people clicking? Do you think one is more popular than the other? Anybody care to guess how many vote for easy? How many vote for fast? Okay. Well, here's what happened. Easy got 0.8%. Fast got 1.3%. That means in Google's system, this one costs 50% more to run than this one. All things being equal. You got to bid 50% more on this ad than this ad to keep them in the same place. So that's Google charging more money for the less relevant advertiser. Very Darwinian, right? So here's my... Since this is Darwinian, and since Darwinian evolution is based on random mutation, right? I wrote a random mutation generator. Actually, I hired a software program, and he had a... Have me write, you can go to randommutation.com and you can play with it. Okay? And it's great. And so if you go there right now, it's got a sentence in there, the quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog. You can paste anything you want in there and you can click mutate. And it'll change something. Okay? And so we can mutate Google ads and we can see if random mutations help us get better ads. So this is our ad. This is after one mutation. What happened? The I turned into a zero, okay? After five mutations, That's what it looks like. Simple self-defense for ordinary people, easy personal protective train of. Okay, after 10 mutations, simple self-defense for ordinary geeple, MZ personal protective train of. Okay, after 50 mutations, you can't even recognize it anymore. Okay, now, I don't have time to go into all the engineering about this, but basically, in engineering, which my engineering degree is in communication engineering, and as a matter of fact, I even wrote a book. I wrote this book about 4 years ago. It's called Industrial Ethernet. It's a very specialized book. Ethernet is the blue cable that you plug in your computer to network all your computers together. And so I got this Ethernet book. And one of the things about communication is see, DNA is a four-letter alphabet, right? A, C, G, T. DNA is a digital communication mechanism. Okay? Your hard drive in your computer or the internet or whatever, it's ones and zeros. It's a two-letter alphabet. Okay? DNA and ones and zeros, same thing. It's a code. It's a two-letter alphabet versus a four-letter alphabet. And all of the math and all the technical stuff and everything that makes all the ones and zeros go back and forth on the internet also gives you the ability to figure out, do random mutations help DNA? Or do they just destroy the information? Well, in engineering, we have a word for mutations. Do you know what it is? Noise. Now, this is a TV. And this is turned to some channel. This is like, you know, channel 83 or something. This is noise. If you wanted to see what random mutations look like, this is what they look like. Now, here's the question. How much of that do you add to a clear picture to make it better? Would you like 1% of that? Would you like 5% of that? Would you like 0.01% of that? How much of this is good? Zero. Zero. Now, every time you surf the internet, every time you send an email, every time you boot up your hard disk, there's a whole bunch of mechanisms that make sure that the information got sent back and forth correctly. You don't even know it. Every time you get an email, there's a complicated little program that detects if the message came intact or not. Okay? And because in internet, radio, TV, whatever, noise is bad. You ever get a garbled email? Somebody sends you a file and you can't open it. Would you resend it? Then they resend it, then you can open it. Well, that's because you've got corrupted data. Corrupted data always destroys information. It never improves information. Once in a blue moon, you might be able to think of a way that maybe it could, but pretty much, in general, it destroys information. Well, you know what? DNA has error correction mechanisms too. It's got a whole bunch of things to make sure that when it copies correctly. And the error rate in DNA is one part per billion. That's how good the error correction mechanisms are. Okay? What does that mean? That means that random mutation, if evolution is true, if it is, if the antelope evolved into a giraffe, it wasn't because of anything random. Okay? And you can take that to the bank. Random mutations destroy antelopes. They don't turn them into giraffes. And there's a biological precedent for this. There was a guy named Theodosius Dobzhansky for 30 years, starting in 1906. He had a hypothesis. He said, fruit flies only take like 12 days to make a new generation. So they proliferate very fast. And so he got all these fruit flies and he started bombarding them with radiation to make their DNA mutate. Okay, and he spent 30 years trying to make the fruit fly turn into a new species. Okay, you know what he got? He got diseased fruit flies, he got discolored fruit flies, he got fruit flies with legs growing out of their mouth. He got all kinds of crazy stuff, but he never got an improved fruit fly after 30 years. Okay? Doesn't that sound suspicious, like being 50 miles away from the TV station? You know, it's getting worse, not better. You know, would you ever say, well, you know, there's 100,000 people in town, and they're all a long way from the TV station, and one of them should be getting a better signal by accident? No, it's ridiculous. It's got to be the biggest hoax in modern science. So random mutation plus natural selection plus time equals extinction. I'd like you to think about how we use the word evolution. Is evolution in every, it's a household word, right? You talk about the evolution of the cell phone market or the evolution of politics or the evolution of the English language, right? Now, are all those things, are they random or are they intelligently directed?
Definitely intelligent.
They're intelligently directed. You know, the early iPod turns into the new iPod, which turns into the iPod Mini and the iPod Video and whatever else to come up. That's evolution, isn't it? And they've done a really remarkable job of selling these things. That's evolution. And it's intelligently designed, isn't it? Every instant, every time you and I use the word evolution, it refers to an intelligently designed process where survival of the fittest happens. But it's always, always intelligently designed. The only kind of evolution that anybody says is random is Darwinian evolution. Well, Darwinian evolution doesn't work. That's why they're always arguing about the fossils, because the math doesn't work. The DNA story doesn't work. All they have is anecdotal evidence, and they don't have another explanation. Now, I ran into a paper where a guy discovered that when he had these little protozoas, you know, a little tiny microorganism, and he discovered that when he put them under extreme stress, a protozoa would slice its own DNA into over 100,000 pieces, rearrange them in a very precise engineered fashion, and make a new protozoa that had a different set of characteristics. This is like a computer program that rewrites itself. Okay? And this is actually how your immune system is able to adapt to almost anything. Your immune system does that. Okay? Now that's intelligent evolution. That's engineered evolution. So, did the antelope evolve into a giraffe? Bible doesn't say one way or the other, really. And I don't have a theological reason to pick one over the other. But if it did happen, it happened as an engineered process that was designed to be able to happen, not as some haphazard thing. And so, do we live in a purposeless universe? No, we don't. We live in a very purposeful universe. We have very adaptive bodies, and they are designed. They are undoubtedly designed. I think I might be almost done here. Let's see. Oh, yeah, I am done, but let's notice something. In Genesis 1, every act of creation is the product of the spoken word. Is it not? And God said, let there be light. And God said, let there be. And God said, let there be. And then John 1:1 says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. And He created. Through Him, all things were created. And apart from Him, nothing was created that has been created. Hebrews 1 says, He is the exact image of God, the exact representation of His nature. That Jesus Christ is the Word. Now, isn't it interesting that words and language are the basis of all creative acts? And words and language are the basis of all things that create. When a cell divides and creates another cell, it does so because it's programmed with words that tell it how to do that. So once again, we have an exact correspondence between the New Testament description of creation in John chapter 1 and everything that we know about anything that is designed. That it's all based on words. Because the idea has to precede the implementation. Designs don't just happen spontaneously. They're always premeditated. Okay? And this has a whole bunch of other implications I don't even have time to talk about. But I guess what I would say to you is the Christian has nothing to be ashamed of in the world of modern science. Okay? The biblical worldview and the scientific worldview match perfectly, as well they should. And so, you know, there's a lot of people, they try to make Christians feel like we're all a bunch of idiots. No, we're not. Sometimes, you know, when your faith is challenged, you have to take a little bit of time and go learn and research and study. And in fact, I think it's that constant dialogue between faith and science that causes science to go forward. Because Isaac Newton and Copernicus and Galileo and all those guys, they believed that God's universe was capable of going on without God having to tinker with it. They thought God as a designer would be more impressive if he didn't have to tinker with it all the time. And so they said, well, let's find laws that explain why this, you know, magnificent machine operates the way it does. And again, to find those laws was an act of worship. And so, to me, looking in the sky, reading a biology book, reading a research paper, watching the birds fly, all those things are acts of worship. And that's really the true purpose of science, is to give glory to God. And that's my story. I'm sticking to it. So...